An Open House Rural Communities Committee. Today is February, what day? 4th, 2014. And we are going to open an organizational meeting. And we are going to consider our committee rules. You've probably all been in committees already and done this in other committees. These are the same rules that have been adopted in other committees, as far as I know, without amendment. You're not supposed to, anyway, try and amend them on the fly in just one committee. I would look for a motion from my vice chair.
Yes, Chair Clem, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2014.
Vice Chair McEwen moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2014. Is there any discussion? Any objection? I'll have to actually call roll. Okay, with seeing none, the rules are so adopted. And then we will open, we put on here introduction of committee members. I mean, this is, okay. Let's go through it. For those of you who are here don't know who we are, this is the first committee of our session, so let's introduce ourselves.
Hello, I'm Representative John Davis, representing Wilsonville, Sherwood, King City, Hillsboro, Tigard, Beaverton, Alloa, unincorporated Washington, and Clackamas Counties.
So jealous of your list. This is so
long. I'm Representative Ben Unger. I represent House District 29, which is Hillsboro, Cornelius, Forest Grove, Verborton, Roy.
This is not as long as yours.
I am Representative McEwen from House District 9, and I'm very proud to represent Yahats, Florence, Reedsport, Coos Bay, North Bend, Scottsburg, Mapleton, Deadwood, Swiss Home, and I have five voters in Elmira.
State Representative Paul Holby, House District 8, and her Elmira are not actually... their Elmira addresses,
yes,
maybe.
Yes, they are.
So, I represent Elmira.
Oh.
I only have five.
South Eugene, Notai, Walton, Lorain, Crow, and a few other places. South to the Douglas County and Lane County line on the south. And go around the outskirts of Cottage Grove and Cresswell as well.
And I'm Brian Clem. I represent Salem, and as we'll hear in a minute on another bill, an unannexed portion of Marion County that resides just east of Salem and kind of likes it that way. Okay, so let's move into our 4016. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4016. Colleagues, this is the bill we had a little discussion of prior to... Well, we had the discussion about rural economic revitalization in general with the NCSL gentleman who flew out here in committee days sometime a few months ago. November. And then this is some of the work product out of that. We talked about this a little in January as one of our committee bills, and here it is. So, with that, why don't we have Alex Campbell, John Saris, and Karen Godden come on up. We've got one amendment, some dash ones, that we'll talk about in just a second. And just so you know, there is a Senate version that's pretty close that's also moving. Ours goes to Ways and Means because it has some money being appropriated in it. Maybe that the other one gets over here before ours gets any money, so we'll figure out later which version to work, just depending on how we fare down in Ways and Means. So, welcome. Whoever would like to go first.
Thank you. For the record, Karen Godden, Managing Director, Business Innovation and Trade at Business Oregon. I'd like to thank you for the invitation for the panel to join you today. I have a few very brief opening remarks, and then you will hear from John Saris on the EDLF request for an increase, and from Alex Campbell with the partnership from Economic Development of Douglas County. We are very supportive of the bill and have been before the committee previously in support of both increasing capital and capacity building programs, establishing support to help rural communities stand up and build on the companies or build the companies who are there, in, I think it was November, could have been October, when the National Conference of State Legislator Executive was here, and he talked about the importance of cluster-based strategies, making sure there's capital capacity building to really assist business new starts and entrepreneurial programs. And last month we also were before the committee and mentioned the department is piloting a entrepreneur program, Coos Curry and Douglas County, and Alex will be talking a little bit more about that effort. So again, we are delighted to be here. I think it most importantly to talk about the EDLF and the pilot project. So John, if you want to go ahead and talk about that detail of it.
Sure. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at Business Oregon. The Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund is a program that provides direct loans to help startups and also small businesses expand or become established here in Oregon. This is a fund that helps fill a funding gap between startups and later stage financing that's offered traditionally through private lending institutions. According to the 2012 capital scan that was commissioned by the Oregon State Treasurer's Office, the Oregon Community Foundation, Meyer Memorial Trust, and Business Oregon, the EDLF microlending program was the largest program of its kind in the state. The proposed legislation would help the program better meet the needs of small businesses that are starting up and expanding. The increased loan limits will help the program to provide additional working capital, provide additional lending capacity for businesses with higher and larger significant inventory, equipment, and tenant improvement needs. The increased limits will better position the program to participate with local revolving loan programs such as the intermediary relending programs administered by economic development districts across the state, really helping leverage their limited resources and sharing some of the risks in these startup and expansion opportunities. The EDLF program is one that provides direct financial assistance to traded sector retail and service industries, most of which are rural small businesses, and this financing is critical to help them with their startup. The EDLF program doesn't compete with private lending. A lot of the applicants that we see and process applications for typically would not qualify for most private loans through banks and credit unions. The goal of the program really is to get these businesses credit worthy and graduate them into more traditional conventional lending programs. Over the last two biennia, the program demand has continued to increase sharply just because unsecured debt and other forms of equity like home equity loans and lines of credit have been harder to come by. 85%, as I mentioned, the loans that we make are made in rural communities outside of the Portland metro market. Finally, Business Oregon is supportive of these changes and believe that they would be prudent program enhancements, and we'd be happy to answer any questions specific to the program itself.
Any questions?
I've been brief. Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. How effective has the program been? What's the repayment rate been? What's the default rate been? Explain to us why it's wise to increase the principal amounts allowed.
Chair Representative Davis, the program has been successful in the last really 4 years. We've lent nearly $2 million out. Repayment history, I think you need to look at it over a couple of periods of time. If you look at the total program since it was incepted in 1991, the repayment history is roughly, or default rate's been about 15%. There's been a number of things that have been done to the program to make it stronger. One of them is actually requiring that these businesses go through a small business management course with a local small business development center or technical assistance provider. That, in essence, has dropped the default rate down actually under 10% right now. Microlending is a very risky business, and it is something that, you know, we have the ability and capacity to do because we don't have a lot of the other overhead that private lenders typically do.
Follow up. And do you have examples of borrowers who come and said we want 90,000 as opposed to 70, and what would the effect have been in those instances?
Chair, members of the committee, Right now, when we've seen loans, a lot of times we'll see loans come in at the maximum. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that's because of the training that we do with the SBDCs and the counselors that put together the loan packages. We believe that there are projects that could benefit from larger loans. And really where the benefit does come in at times is on second rounds of financing. They will come in and they'll meet the initial need, their initial needs, but maybe they need to acquire another piece of equipment, or maybe they need additional inventory. A lot of times, unless you've had 18 to 24 months of financial history, you really don't qualify for traditional bank financing. And so that allows them to actually obtain that, grow, continue to grow, and then be more bankable 24 to 36 months down the road.
Thanks. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and thanks for coming. Everybody wants to help out business and job growth and all that. How do you measure success? How do you say, well, this is a successful program, therefore we want to expand it? What is your measurement for success?
Go ahead and start, and John can talk very specifically about the finance. We do track, we have performance-based measures, both the key performance measures that report out how many companies are served, have they met the goals, what are the level of activities, have the companies been successful in the portfolio of lending, was it repaid, what's the ratio. So there's a set of criteria that's used to evaluate whether it's this program, the Small Business Development Centers, the Oregon Entrepreneur Network, anything that we provide resources to, we have a set of measures that we use.
Chair Representative Thatcher, I think Karen hit most of the metrics for this particular program. You look at demand, how many projects are being referred to this particular program through the various networks statewide. Then you look at the repayment history, what is the default rate look like. And one thing that we do is when we have a business that is in default, we'll work with them. We'll continue to provide technical assistance and training to help, basically keep that business around if at all possible. After that, it really, those are the demand side pieces of it, and we just try to ensure that it's not an administrative burden, that the interest income coming back in covers the administrative expenses and losses.
Chair McEwen.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here today. Thank you very much. These are important issues in rural communities, certainly, and I know there's some focus on that with this particular program. I'm interested in if there's overlap or connection between this particular program and the Small Business Development Centers across the state. I know we've worked very hard to make sure that they're funded at a level that's meaningful as we come out of the recession, and that our small businesses that are starting up or trying to grow have opportunities to educate themselves well so they can be successful. So can you touch on that a little bit about how you interact with that program?
Chair, Representative McEwen. Yes, the SBDC, the centers have been critical to the success of this program. Really, the role of the networks themselves for this particular program is to provide business counseling and mentoring to these businesses. If they're in a startup, they're reviewing the business plan. If they're in growth, they're making sure that they have, the financial acumen to manage their books and add staff or meet whatever business need that they have. So this tool really provides the capital that those businesses need to actually achieve that growth or take advantage of the opportunity that they're pursuing. So the relationship there is that the Small Business Development Center networks are providing the technical assistance, and the state through this particular program are actually funding the projects themselves.
Thank you.
Representative Holley.
Thank you. I was trying not to ask a Ways and Means question, but since this is a policy committee, but part of this bill does appropriate $250,000 from the general fund. Is that money that's already been set aside by the Ways and Means Committee earmarked for this fund in 2013, or is this a new request?
No.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, it would be new money as I understand it and has not been set aside.
That's right.
So we don't know how it's going to turn out down there is the bottom line. We're going to try, but we don't know.
Chair Clem.
Representative Davis.
Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to follow up. What's the current size of the loan fund? I missed that.
Chair Representative Davis, currently we have about $1.6 million in available cash to lend, and we have about $2 million in receivables, so the total loan fund itself is about $3.6 million.
Thank you.
And Alex, did you want to weigh in? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Alex Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Partnership for Economic Development in Douglas County. And my colleagues at Business Oregon invited me here today because we're one of the regional economic development organizations that is working on supporting entrepreneurship. So I thought I'd just give you all a few words on why we're doing that and comments about what we see the additional funding, if the state was able to put it into this area, could mean on the ground. So we're focusing, and not entirely, but some of our efforts to support entrepreneurial development, just because we see the things that I'm sure you're all aware of, you know, the structural transformation of Oregon's rural economies continues. And when we look at the long trend, we see in the 1970s, 40% of our employment in Douglas County was in the mills and in logging. It's now about 10%. And I feel those jobs are absolutely critical, and, you know, we're going to continue to support them, but they're never going to return in terms of a share of employment to what they were in the past. And when we look today, 9 of the top 10 private employers in Douglas County are all businesses that were founded there in Douglas County. So thinking about the long-term economic health of the region, we think it's critical that we're sort of, you know, sowing the seeds of those future businesses and supporting them as they get off the ground. We've expanded our retention and expansion targets. So we're working with businesses across sort of the life cycle, rather than in the past it had been really sort of 10 or 15 employees and up that we were targeting. We've also put together an angel investor network that invested about $140,000. They're about to close it. That we had a conference in the fall. We've been supporting a young entrepreneur society of UMQA, which is just a local meetup group where folks can get together and share ideas, share inspiration. And we've really integrated. We sit within the UMQA Business Center, which is a new incubator supported by USEDA and the Cowichan Creek Tribe, and we're co-located there with the Small Business Development Center. So we're really trying to provide more cohesive business services to all kinds of businesses at one location. The OEN project that's already being funded is going to continue to look at what are the particular challenges of rural entrepreneurship. I'm relatively new to a rural environment, but so one of the things that I've realized is that the difference is very much about the density of population. That's kind of the only difference in some ways, which in some ways surprised me. But that difference in density has some pretty significant impact, particularly when you talk about the kinds of efforts that have been done to support entrepreneurship in sort of Portland metro area. I mean, the density of those networks and all the incubators that are operating, you know, really provide a qualitatively different environment. So we need to figure out what it is that we need to do in a rural context to support folks. The resources that the state's already providing are absolutely critical. We generated recently, with the support of the SBDC counselors, two EDLF loans to two local companies that are growing and are employing more people. So the access to capital is a challenge, but there is capital there. We need more, but we need the expertise. And you know, I'm the executive director of 1.5 people, so you know, it'll give you a sense of the resources that we're working with, and the majority of our funding, I would also like to say, is ultimately from state lottery dollars. So your economic development dollars are already supporting us. So I'm here in support, and I appreciate the support the state's already given us to do our job down there. I'd welcome any questions.
Representative Holvey, can come in this way.
Just a quick one, and I apologize if you already had this in your testimony. So of the $250,000, what do you have, like a target of what percentage of that money would go to loans as opposed to direct assistance for activities?
Thank you, Representative or Chair Clem, Representative Holvey. Of the $250,000, we believe approximately $85,000 is needed to support a similar pilot, like the pilot program. We're only halfway funding the pilot project at $45,000. We'd like to increase that with additional dollars, but there's a number of other places around the state in southern Oregon, eastern Oregon. So we believe it's roughly between $60,000 and about $85,000 would be needed. That involves both a little bit of hiring, but most of it being put into supporting the types of programs and assistance and activities that bring together people who have the skills to work with the entrepreneurs and the businesses. These funds would not be used in the loan portfolio or would be lent out, just to be clear. For that piece of it.
To be clear, so are you saying $85,000 of the $250,000 is used for the activity and the balance of that is used for loans, or none of it is used for loans?
None of the $250,000 would be used for loans.
None of the $250,000
right,
for loans.
Correct.
Okay, thanks. That's what I was trying to figure out.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
And then Representative Thatcher, did you?
Thank you. I just need some clarification. I was just looking on the Oregon Business Oregon, I got that wrong, Business Oregon site, and it's a wealth of information. There's a lot in there. There's also a list of available finance programs. I'm not seeing this one in there, and I'm wondering, is that somewhere else, and how would somebody find out about the program and whether or not they would, you know, be a candidate to participate?
Chair Representative Thatcher, from our website, you would click on the financing resources, and then on the next bullet down, it starts to list the business finance programs. Click into that, and the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund should be one of the seven or eight resources that we have for small business in that list. And there's also a financing widget that's on that, so a business could actually go in and kind of characterize what kind of a credit project they had, and it would actually link them up with the type of financing resources that the state could offer to help with that particular project.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I do see Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. I was looking for Industry Competitiveness Fund, Meyer. I don't know why. That's what it says.
And Vice Chair McKeown.
Actually, those were the issues I was going to get at, but I would like to follow up and welcome you to Southwestern Oregon. Rural communities have a wealth of opportunity now as people are trying to do some very creative things, and I think there's great potential across this state outside the metro area to do some things that can take advantage of our young people who want to return home and businesses that have been struggling for a very long time and want to begin to grow back out of this recession. So I know you mentioned a couple of projects that you've been participating in. Could you just give us one example of one that you worked with and how that project went? And we don't need a great deal of time, but it would be nice to have an example of something that's been successful in our rural communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Angel Investor Network that I mentioned, that investment, that fund came from $25,000 was contributed from the Oregon Growth Account, but the rest of the $140,000 was from individuals in Douglas County, and actually we had a Coos County resident who's an investor and a couple down in Jackson County. They came together. We did the project primarily because we saw it as a critical educational tool to have the conference, to have the applicants, to have trainings around the competition for the investment. We also did a prize for an earlier stage company. And we opened the investment opportunity to any Oregon-based company. We were really hopeful that we would have, ultimately in years to come, local companies that could reach the level of quality that they could effectively compete for that investment. We knew in this first year that that was unlikely. One of the five finalists was a local company. They're making concrete ping pong tables and concrete foosball tables now. They had a tremendous experience just going through the competition, experiencing the training, seeing the level that the other companies that they're competing at were at. And my investors came back together in December and January and said, we really want to do this again. We really want to figure out how it is that we get our local companies to a point where they can effectively compete for our investment. So they will be doing that. If we had additional resources, whether it's, a specialized consultant in a particular industry, that we are struggling to find expertise in, things like that, that would be gold for us.
Follow up. One of the things that's been high on the radar is in the agricultural industry, and particularly in specialty foods, whether it's fish or cranberries or blueberries or cheese, or of course brewing is high on everybody's radar. But is this an opportunity also for those who are involved in agricultural practices to become involved? Because we have quite a few entrepreneurial folks who are interested in marketing specialty foods far and wide. So is that also on the radar?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth noting that out of this industry competitiveness fund, one of the other things that we've been participating in is Business Oregon has been supporting a food processing focused effort that is being led by the Oregon Economic Development Association, OEDA, and there's a similar group that's working around transportation and warehousing, and those are both places where I think Business Oregon has been really responsive to rural economic development organizations, saying the tech, the solar focus isn't bringing jobs to our communities. We want to work in areas like food processing, and I think that we've seen some real response to that.
Thank you.
And do you want to just tell us a little bit about these Dash 1 amendments, so the committee knows it lengthens the time, the repayment period?
Oh, John, too.
Yeah, Chair. The Dash 1 amendments, I believe, quite simply, take the maximum loan term and increase it from 5 years to 10 years. And one of the reasons for that is, as you make a larger loan, you're typically financing bigger assets. It's common in commercial lending to go ahead and stretch out the term as long as it's financing for the useful life of the asset. So basically what this will do is help that business better service the debt for a little bit larger loan.
Okay, any more questions? Good, thank you. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4016, open a work session on House Bill 4016, and look for a motion.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Vice Chair McEwen moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. These are the discussion. These are the ones we just talked about that lengthen the term of the loan. Repayment period from 5 to 10 years. Okay. Any further discussion on the Dash 1s on the term lengthening? Okay. Any objections? Okay. Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Nervously look around. Yes.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 4016 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair McEwen moves House Bill 4016 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Thatcher.
I love that we're always focused on, getting new ways to help out the small guy. I appreciate that. I'm not quite there yet. I want to see, we've got so many of these things out there. I mean, just within this agency, and then we have other agencies that also do things that are in the name of economic development that we don't even know what we have, and expand, I don't know. I just would like us to direct our efforts towards those things that we know work the best, maybe phase out a few things that aren't as good. This might be just grand, but I'm just not there yet.
So you're thinking
I'm
like
going to
tomorrow
be a no for now.
You might be there if we waited, or probably not really?
You know, I'm going to do some looking around, but
okay.
Just for now.
Okay.
I'm just saying I'm a no.
Okay.
Just giving you
that.
Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually like the policy in the Section 1 of this bill, and you know, a little bit nervous about extending the loan time to 10 years. It takes longer for the state to get money back, but I could probably live with that, but I'm a little bothered by Section 2, you know, that's giving the $250,000, and I worry that the policy disappears in the Ways and Means process because they're not going to come up with the 250 grand. So I'm a little nervous about that piece of the bill. I'm going to be supporting it because I like the policy in the bill, but I worry by adding that $250,000 mandate in Section 2, you will see this bill disappear or die in Ways and Means, and we will have lost at least the policy initiative.
So the plan B here is Senator Rosenbaum. She's got the bill coming without the money.
Okay.
So just in case it gets rat-holed in Ways and Means, we should see another version here with Senate approval at that point.
Yeah, the plot thickens.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to cover my bases here. You're right. It's a dangerous situation sending something down there if we want it, you know, to go through.
Chair, what was that term for Ways and Means?
Rat-hole.
Okay.
I'm not on there anymore. Oh, here's a chair right there. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, oh, this won't come to my subcommittee. It very well may be a rat-hole someplace else. Not mine.
So that's my operating theory.
I would never use those terms to describe our fellow colleagues. You may have a bill down there, too, you know.
I do now. That's the problem. Okay. Further discussion. Seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll on our amended 4016.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Unger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Excuse.
Vice Chair McHugh.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Bill passes and is moved down to the really nice Committee on Ways and Means. Nobody would ever call a rat hole. I'm going to amend the tape on that one. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on, I'm going to do House Bill 4128 because we've already seen it in this committee before once, and we only have one speaker, and then we can spend the rest of our time on our other bill, I think most people are here for. So, House Bill 4128, I'll talk about it. It's my bill. Those of you who were on the committee before will remember this bill, potentially. It just went to the floor, and then it just came back. And it stayed here. So, the details of the bill, this bill applies to cities that have charter amendments or policies that vote on all the annexations in their cities. So it's only those cities that this would apply to. And what it says is in cities that do vote on them, if they're using the island method, it would place a limit on what we would call the single majority method, where the people who are going to be annexed potentially and the city electors vote in a combined majority, and whoever gets the most votes basically wins. It would put a limit where the island method would still be used in that single majority manner up to 100 acres. After 100 acres, this bill would change it to a double majority where the island would need to approve it and the city would need to approve it. And the basic theory here is that islands are appropriate ways to take in small parcels with not that many people who are very tough to service because they're kind of out stranded down the middle of the city. And that giant islands of a large nature aren't really islands and would be better served by some other method of annexation. Somebody down there didn't vote for it last time. I know I'm not going to get them this time either, but I'm trying. So the cities that don't have charter amendments, obviously this doesn't apply to, but the cities that do have charter amendments, this would create a statute modeled after Washington on the kind of size of acreage that you would use on islands. It's not a prohibition. It just changes the way you count the votes on islands over 100 acres. So that's my explanation. Any questions for me?
Are these literally islands surrounded by water?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're small, like tropical islands.
Oh, good.
In the middle of town.
Yeah, Indonesian.
Okay, Aaron. You can ask me questions after Aaron's done, too, if you want. Not that we haven't already had this debate here, but it's back. I didn't bring the other one back. I thought I was judicious, no?
Yes. Chair Clem, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. We obviously continue to oppose this bill. I'm sure we're all shocked.
Huh?
But we believe this still is an impediment to responsible, well-managed urban growth and disincentivizes voters within an island to support annexation to the city. First, large island, like 100-acre islands, prevent responsible urbanization and orderly transition from rural to urban areas if they don't come in to the city boundaries. Cities do master plans, comprehensive plans, UGB expansions based on land need and service provision. We plan infrastructure out, and if you have a large island in the middle of the city's boundaries, that influences how cities have to make those decisions and hampers efficient growth management. Second, it discourages cities from looking internally for areas of growth, redevelopment, and infill, and instead turns our focus to areas outside that are easier to get than trying to have a double majority of vote. So we look to areas outside the city limits, and instead of building up, we build out and affect the forest and farm areas to the outside of our city boundaries. Third, it places a burden on the relationship between counties and cities as we have to coordinate how services are provided into the areas that are islands. It requires the counties to come in and make expenditures in what are becoming increasingly urban areas, which is not generally the county's focus. Usually urban areas should be handled by city government. That's what they're there for, is for urban densities. So a large island that's already developed into urban densities gets serviced by the county. That puts a burden on where the county has to manage its funds, and where we might be more able to effectively administrate those services. Or else they do intergovernmental agreements between the city and the county to just have the city provide the services and then pay us the money, and that money might be better spent in other areas of the counties. And our services can be more efficiently provided if it's all under one house, basically. And that is the summation of my testimony, which I think you've heard before, and I've talked to you each individually on this issue. So I'm happy to answer any further questions.
I thought it was a little stronger. Like, you were in your first few weeks on the job. It's a little, it's pretty good. I'm reconsidering. Oh, wait, no. Questions for Aaron? Okay. Oh, yeah, Representative Holby.
So I was listening to your testimony very closely, and so do you think that this proposal will hamper or deter the development of land inside the urban growth boundaries?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, when cities do urban planning and comprehensive planning, we plan for higher densities and more urban development within those areas, and we would not include necessarily we wouldn't be making land use decisions for those areas. Those areas would be controlled by county plans and wouldn't necessarily rise to the density and urbanization levels that they would under city control.
Oh, boy. I don't think I'm getting you. Yeah. Any more questions for Aaron? Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now I've got to go get a vice chair back. Oh, no, Ben, sorry, I think we missed, I think I missed my window.
She'll be back.
Awesome.
3:45 was the deadline. Let me recess for just a moment.
Cool. Wait a minute. Good enough.
Yeah.
Good enough.
Hold on. Let me recess for just a moment. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4128 and open a work session on House Bill 4128.
Mr. Chair, I move that we that HB 4128 be reported out of the committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Unger moves that House Bill 4128 be reported out of the committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if I recall, I didn't support this bill last session, and after the testimony, I'm sure I'm not going to support it again.
Okay.
I really think this policy is contrary to urban growth, essentially, and puts pressure on the expansion of urban growth boundaries into farmlands. And so as such, I don't think this is really a great policy, and I'm trying to envision this 100-acre island where people are surrounded, evidently because they're an island, by city and city services, and it's hard for me to imagine that those residents of that island do not benefit from the services that are provided by the city, though they may pay through some sort of agreement. I don't think that's an equitable form of taxation for people within an urban growth boundary, and for those reasons, I will not be supporting this bill. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Holvey?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Unger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron?
Excused.
Vice Chair McHugh?
Excused.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes. The bill will go to the floor. Okay. Now, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 4078. And I want to ask Tom Hughes, the president, the right term, head of our Metro Council, chairman, president of the Metro Council, that's what I thought. And is Jerry still with us, mayor of Hillsborough? Why don't you two gentlemen come up? And for those of the rest of you here, I want to, yes, please. I want to outline sort of where we're at. We've got...
Did you see Mayor Doyle here
huh?
as well?
Yeah, sorry, I did not see him on the list. But yep, come on up. So we've got the bill, House Bill 4078, that those of you who have been watching see it online. Then we've got some amendments that were posted earlier today. So you may not have had the chance to see the amendments if you aren't on the Internet tracking this. We're going to hear about the amendments in large part now and some details on them, hopefully for those of you who haven't even read them. But when you come to testify on 4078, which you're certainly welcome to do, if you have thoughts about this new approach the amendments are describing, because they completely eliminate the other bill and go a whole different way, feel free to weigh in on the amendments, too, after you've listened to what's said here about the amendments. Or you can just blast away or say how much you love the original bill. But your choice. I just want people, and these are called the dash threes, and are there copies back there? Maybe there should be copies back there. And we're going to hear a little bit about them, too, I think, as we go. Yep, and they're on the list. So, Mr. President, welcome to the House Rural Communities Committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tom Hughes. And I'm chairman of the president. President of the Metro Council that represents that great rural area called urban Portland. And I was going to follow Representative Davis and Unger and list the cities that there's 25 of them, along with three counties, including most of the ones that the Representative Davis and Unger mentioned. I want to thank the sponsors of this measure, and particularly Representative Davis, for bringing this issue forward to the committee. It has caused a great deal of angst and frustration, I think, in the metropolitan area in Portland. And I think part of it is because most of us participated in a very lengthy, very detailed, very public process of establishing first urban reserves and rural reserves that will ultimately identify 28,000 acres of land that would be ultimately subject to urbanization, and protected about 260,000 acres of farmland, or 270,000 acres of farmland, for the next 50 years. That process having been done, we then moved on to the urban growth boundary and established an urban growth boundary that was really a relatively minor expansion of the urban growth boundary, considering that it hasn't been expanded for a while, of about 1,700 acres, mostly in the jurisdiction of the two gentlemen on either side of me. The people, in particularly in South Hillsboro, although I think there's some urgency in South Cooper Mountain area also that Mayor Doyle can address, really represent, I think, if you go to the dictionary and look under patient capital, you'll find the folks at Newland Communities and Joe Hanauer, who owns some land just south of theirs. They've been in this now for about 17 years, and probably longer that they've been thinking about it. And they've gone through two or three efforts to get it into the urban growth boundary that have failed. And they finally now, I think, are at the final stages of bringing that in. And it's understandable then the frustration that occurs because it has taken the courts what seems like a fairly long amount of time, although we're a year away from the time when they had the oral arguments, and we're told that it generally is 18 to 24 months after that point in time before a decision of the Court of Appeals is reached. So, but it seems like a long time, in part because it has taken us a long time to get here, and it certainly has been a long time for the property owners who are affected. We think we did a good job. We think we understand the law. We helped to write the law, working with our partners. I was actually a mayor of the city of Hillsboro at the time. Hillsboro Metro worked together to get a bill that had virtually little opposition by the time it worked through in terms of establishing urban reserves. We helped LCDC write the rules. We think we understand what those rules mean and how they apply to state law, and we think we applied them correctly. So we don't think there is much chance that the courts are going to reverse much of what we did. There may be a remand, there may be a tweak, but by and large, we think that is going to go pretty quickly. We think the problem in the process is not that the process is broken, not that it's too complex, but that it takes too long. And in the cases, land use cases that go to the LUBA, the Land Use Court of Appeals, there is a statutory limitation on the amount of time that the review can take before a decision is reached. And what we're saying essentially in the amended version of the bill, what we're asking for is to add those limitations to measures that come through the LCDC and then the Court of Appeals process also. And we think
these are the dash threes.
These
that
are
I
yeah,
just
the
referenced.
Dash threes, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. We don't, we think that what the legislature has created back with Senate Bill 100 is a process where the state creates a structure for how to do this, and then they leave it to the local governments to do it, and then LCDC to make sure that we've done it according to state law. We think that getting the legislature involved in the final decision, even if it's confirming what that process has done, really adds a complexity to it that makes future decisions somewhat up in the air. Quite frankly, this is a two-step process. It's become a three-step process because almost every UGB expansion has been referred to the courts. So we tend to think of the courts as a third step. They aren't really. It's really a two-step process. We don't want to make the legislature a fourth step. And we think the original bill offered the opportunity for that to happen. But we think that there is a place where the process needs to be changed and tweaked and made to work a little bit more efficiently. And what the Dash 3 amendments do is they make this change not just for the current folks who are waiting to see the results of this, but for all subsequent land use decisions that we make under the UGB laws as they are. And so I have included a letter which my council authorized me to send you, and we're here today to urge the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay. And whichever mayor would love to start. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chair Clem, and certainly committee members, thank you. My name is Jerry Willey. I am the mayor of Hillsboro, and I am accustomed to following Tom, and usually my remarks are considerably briefer than Tom, so I will try and continue that vein. We are obviously in support of House Bill 4078, and the reasons are similar to what Tom has just gone through. I've been mayor now, this is my sixth year, and three of the first years that I was mayor, I dealt in negotiations with the entire region and all kinds of representatives from different agencies and different organizations on trying to find a happy place for 50 years of growth, and then identifying, of course, the urban growth boundary. I think we were successful in that, and the proof of that is that we had winners and losers, and we were both. Each one of us felt like we had some wins in this, and each one of us felt like we had some losses, and I think that's the important part of the process. The important, from our standpoint, is, as Tom again has reiterated, is that Metro and LDC and three counties all ratified this, and so it is a process that was very complex, very difficult, but we got through to the conclusion of that with that ratification. And the best part about it is it identified 50 years of growth for our Tri-County metro region. And what that allows us all to do then is begin to, design and develop where it is we're going to grow, where it is we are not going to grow, where we can consider putting industrial development, because we have the 330 acres of industrial sanctuary that the city of Hillsboro has identified, as well as where our citizens are going to live. And that for us is South Hillsboro. That's about 1,400 acres of residential development. It's going to house probably close to 25,000 people at full development. It has almost 11,000 new buildings in that. So it is a significant development. Hence, 17 years of master planning, I guess. So what we'd like to encourage is that this process that we're bound up in right now, in the appeals process, this is only stage one of potentially four steps for this process. What is at the appeals court right now is urban and rural reserves. And if that doesn't make the appellants happy, we go to potentially the Supreme Court. Then we move to the urban growth boundary expansions and those appeals and that potential Supreme Court. We are potentially 5 years out before a nail can be driven, a shovel can be put into the dirt. And we are at a time economically where the value and the cost of housing is significantly going up because we have such a shortage. So we have an opportunity here to make several things happen that would be good things for not only our economic development for the state, but certainly to make our employment opportunities better and certainly for our housing. And remember that in 2007, I believe it was, that legislatively the metro region had to address the greenhouse gas issues. And Metro has been working on that for well over a year, called Climate Smart Communities. And the whole premise of how that works better is, quite frankly, having housing close to employment areas. And that's exactly what South Hillsboro does for our North Industrial Employment Area. So what we're asking is for a handout a little bit to help us make this process more efficient, certainly faster, and for the developer, much more certainty involved in the whole process, so that they can be willing to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to make our area much more efficient in not only our transportation but our housing, much more profitable in our economics around the state, and make our citizens the availability of living close to where they work. So we are in strong support of this House bill and certainly the amendments that have gone to it. We are, I think you're seeing three people here at the speaker's table that are all in support of this, and we work together as a region, and we'd like to encourage you to support this. Thank you.
And I should clarify, you're really talking about the Dash 3 amendment
Dash
as well,
three.
Which
that's correct.
Get rid of the original bill and replace with this timeline framework.
That is correct. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Just that's some people here on the underlying bill, too, so I just want to
get them. They're still under.
And Mayor Doyle.
Thank you. I'll be
before
brief.
We start, she did pretty well, didn't she? The other Doyle in the
room. The other Doyle in the
room.
She
was pretty good.
Family
of it was pretty good. I felt like it was pretty strong for Dad.
Yeah. I'm not sure she has had a good role model, but I'll do my best. Shockingly, I will be briefer than Jerry. And amazing, I'll be briefer than Tom, but Chairman, I'm glad you're having the hearing. I appreciate you calling it. And Representative Davis, thank you for bringing what to me is a critical issue before the legislature. You've heard the timelines. We've lived it. And in all honesty, it was not an easy process to go through between the different counties and all the jurisdictions involved. And it's never easy, but we've been charged in Beaverton to plan on a substantial amount of residential demand going up as well as employment. We don't really plan going 5 and 6 and 10 stories in the city. So having...
I'm sorry, I interrupted right before you were about to introduce yourself. So could you, for the record...
I'm sorry. Just like the baseball player, Denny Doyle, mayor of the city of Beaverton. Sorry about that. So this to us is a process that I think was very fair, vetted very well. Lord knows we had enough public hearings and discussions with the public, and if anyone doesn't think so, I'll let you listen to the tapes. So I think it's important that we actually put some kind of shape to the process so it can't go on. Either way, we should know. There's a lot of planning going on. There's a lot of folks looking at building. There's a lot of jobs here. There's a lot of dollars to be spent. And I think, in our case, the school district wants to build their next comprehensive high school in the South Cooper Mountain area. And it'd be good. We operate under pretty stringent controls. When we get an application, it's got to be done 120 days, sometimes 180. Then it's done. Then the next segment can happen. And it's frustrating for everybody to watch a process just sit on a desk door somewhere, at least as I see it. No knock on, people are very busy. Maybe we need to set up a way to streamline the process as we've done in other cases. So I think that the time has come because we're almost ready for the next round of planning to happen. And I'd like to have this one put to bed before we get to the next one. So I will stop there and be happy to take questions. But I thank you very much for bringing this matter up because I think it's absolutely essential to a substantial part of the state.
Questions for these gentlemen? Okay. Oh, Representative Holby.
I'm not sure who the question's for. I see all the timelines in here, and it mentions the courts a lot. You know, the timelines are for the courts generally. So has the state court administrator weighed in on these timelines?
They're on the list to come up here. I have a feeling we're going to hear about that.
Okay, I was just curious about that.
Yeah, we'll get them up here.
That's why I mentioned, you know, everybody's busy, so yeah. Maybe we need to think it through.
Well, and one of the issues that the courts have told us, you quit funding us, things slow down. So I think we just turns to work out that way. So we did put some more money into three new appellate court positions, but you know, it takes time to get caught up with all the times we defunded them. So and so we can wait for him in the list in order. Or do you want to?
Yeah. Wait now? Well, no, I'll wait for those questions. I was just kind of curious. One of them is within 105 days and striking language with the greatest possible expediency, and now you're changing that to within 105 days, and I don't know, I'm just not sure that's going to get you the fastest result, but time will tell.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you. So now I'm going to go to our list. We have a policy here of asking people who've come from more than 100 miles to go first. I don't know what the snow situation is on the pass, but we've got at least one here from Jefferson County who came a long way. So Mickey Killingsworth, can you come up? And then we had a volunteer from the city of Bend to not invoke his privilege and just wait. So I'm going to hold him, and then I'm going to kind of go with panels of for and against so we don't get in any squabbling with your neighbors right there at the dais. So Pat Rebellia, I'm going to have you come up next with the fours and hold tight for now. Hold tight for now. You're the first on the list, but I'm just going to have you come up next with the groups. And so I'm going to get two more against in, which would be Roger Kay and former Congresswoman Elizabeth Furse. So, let's see. Roger, I know. I see you. Come on up. Yes, please. And yeah, and Elizabeth, can you join us? So these are the all against. You can all sit at the same table. I assume everyone can sit at the same table regardless of opinion and be polite, but we tend to group them.
Not in our world.
Yeah, not always. So, Mickey, you're from more than 100 miles, so you're first.
Yes, Chair Clem and committee members. My name is Mickey Killingsworth. I'm from Jefferson County. I belong to Jefferson County Farm Bureau, and I have sat on the Oregon Farm Bureau Land Use Committee probably for 18 years.
Sorry, before you start, you're certainly welcome to differentiate however you want between the bill as you saw it and these amendments, or both, or just one.
Yeah, so I did see the amendments, so I'm going to speak first about the original bill. When Farm Bureau first endorsed the urban rural reserve process as a member of that land use committee, we thought this would be really a great tool because everybody would come in and do it, you know, 50 years. You know, agriculture would have certainty for 50 years instead of every 5 to 7 years going through the UBG process. You know, that's what we thought would happen. So the Farm Bureau members that went through the Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County process, we got to hear lots of not kind comments about the process from Washington County Farm Bureau members on the Land Use Committee. The Clackamas and Multnomah people didn't, their process went smooth. So I want everybody to realize that. Though probably right now, if you would take a vote of our committee, we have many times said we wish we never would have gotten in bed with this process. We wished we would have stayed with the old process where there was defined criteria, you could count on it. But that's not where we're at. That's not where this bill is at. So a process went through. It has been challenged in the courts. And I guess being as old as I am, I grew up, you usually went through legal process work. And the new amendments is talking about timelines to speed up the legal process. So I was hoping that the person from the courts would speak first so I could hear their insight because, you know, I figure they're a lot wiser about process dealing with the courts. But from what I have read, it's mainly the amendments are to speed up timelines at the courts, which I'm not an expert to speak to. But as a farmer, I still say, you know, sometime we're going to have to decide we really want to protect agriculture. And if I could amend this bill, I would do totally away with this whole process that took place and go back to the old one that had concrete criteria. But that's not germane, and I can't do that.
I'm looking at the relating clause. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay.
We could figure out a way, right?
So that would be, if we could figure that one out, that's what I would do. I went online, and I was trying to see if there was going to be a fiscal. So I would assume there'd be a fiscal if you're going to ask LCDC and the courts to move up. Somewhere there has to be a fiscal. Everybody's so strapped now somewhere, but I didn't find that. So, you know, I was...
I mean, there isn't one. We just don't have it. We haven't made the request yet because we're not moving the bill today.
Okay. Yeah. So I was going to say, I tried to find one and I didn't see that.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I know how strapped administrations are in Oregon. So I'm just a simple shepherd from Central Oregon, and I'm just telling you how my heart is, and I'm opposed, you know, and the amendments, I'm not wise enough to speak to the amendments. I'm only wise enough to speak to the passion of the original bill, which I oppose.
And Roger, I've got you next on the list. All right. That's your right. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Elizabeth Furris, and I own a farm in Washington County. I grow grapes. I've given you detailed testimony. It will be there for you in the record. And I'm really here to speak about two issues. One is the protection of Class 1 farmland, which we are so fortunate to have in Washington County, at a higher amount average than anywhere else in Oregon. It's a very precious commodity. Once you've paved it over, it's gone. And then the other thing I'm here to talk about is citizen input. We did give a lot of citizen input to the underlying issue. But I have to tell you that in my experience, the court takes its time. Yes, that may be uncomfortable for some, but it is a guarantee that we have in this country that we take our appeal and we wait for the court to make that decision. I believe it's a bedrock of democracy to be allowed to go to court, and I think we have to protect it as we have to protect farmland. I have a great deal of history in supporting Oregon's land use law, and I would say to you, don't meddle with it. When I was in the United States Congress, Congressman O'Coin had got West Side Light Rail authorized to Hillsborough, but not appropriated. It was my job to find the appropriations to make that happen. I was a freshman. That was kind of a heavy lifting. But the way we did it, and we did get the highest amount of $680 million to that process, the way we did it was that I was able to show the appropriators that in Oregon we have certainty. We know what will happen in the next 5 years in land. We can decide where something is going. And they agreed that certainty was extremely important. It's important to farmers, and it's important to small businesses. And I'm happy to say that Westside Light Rail has the highest new housing of any MAX line in the state. So I support growth, but I support wise, well-planned growth. And I know that it pays off. It's what makes Oregon, Oregon, is the fact that we have this wonderful blend. And yes, of course, every jurisdiction wants to move out, but we have a lot of land within the urban growth boundary. And as far as this bill is concerned, anything that interferes with the citizen's right to appeal. Okay, so I've looked at your amendments. I'm not sure, as a lawmaker, I'm not sure truly whether you have the right to tell a court how quickly they may make a decision. That is the prerogative of the court. We have three types of government, three branches.
Yeah.
And I would want to make absolutely sure that you had real assurances that, in fact, it is up to this body to do that. We relied in Washington County on, well, we relied on Senate Bill 1011, and we went to court on it. And I would say, with the distrust that the citizens of this country have towards government, and I certainly got a lot of that, I would say anything that restricts a citizen's right to that basic right of to take, government does something wrong, you take them to court. That's a very basic right. That's how we got civil rights. It's how we got all the good laws in this country, is that we had the right to appeal. And I think we would lose even more trust if we passed this bill. I would ask this body to, I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I would ask this body to reject this bill. Start again. Start again with something that would increase trust in government rather than decrease it. And I thank you for your time and for such an interest. This has been a very interesting afternoon, and I've heard a lot of testimony in my day, and I know that you're listening very carefully. Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger.
Good afternoon, Chair Klem, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I represent Friends of Marin County. I've submitted testimony in writing that you should have in front of you, along with some testimony from our secretary, Richard Van Pelt, who expresses our view of the original bill and my view of the original bill are quite explicit. We are vigorously opposed to those measures in the original bill. I reviewed the amendments, and I too share Elizabeth First's opinion of the current amendments, and we oppose those also. Remember, we do have three branches of government, and every year I listen to Chief Justice Muniz and now Balmer, and they would often quote the famous phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. However, we have to look at justice accelerated can also lead to justice denied. And if we force the court into making a decision without having all of the issues brought forth at the forum and the decision come out, that's going to give us a wise decision, a carefully thought decision, then we're rushing the court and they're going to make mistakes. And what happens if the appeals court exceeds the time limit appropriated in this bill? Well, where would the measure go? Would it go to the Supreme Court then? Are we looking at stuffing all of these issues into the Supreme Court docket? And that's something that I'm sure no one wants to see. So anyway, we wonder again if there's legality in forcing the court to adopt a time frame. And if there is such a legality, we oppose that because the court needs its due time to weigh all the issues and come up with a value decision. We found out recently in the UGB case in Marion County that the applicant was in error on their arguments, and they eventually, after referral back to DLCD, lost eventually in the Court of Appeals because they felt they could push the case forward, keep on pushing it forward, and basically everyone would give up and throw in a towel. But if you ever look at the decision on the UGB case in Woodburn, you'll see that the local jurisdictions made significant errors, and the court did need that time to adjudicate through those errors and find for us in that case. That's all I had. If you have any questions.
Any questions? The one thing, Congresswoman, I might share with you, we did have an initial amendment, and I got a little kind of nasty gram back from LC saying, you know, you can't do this. This is a separation of powers issue. These amendments I got more like an email that said, I'm not sure. So that's kind of our process. We put it into LC. They give us, as our lawyers, advice of whether we're crossing the line or not. They say, you can do whatever you want, but I'm just telling you, you know, I've got some concerns in this area. This particular one, it's not quite as formal because there's some already existing times we put timelines on the courts, and these sort of tie to those. So it's not clear that it's a home run for separation of powers, but we'll find out, because I'm going to use my prerogative to call the neutrals up and get the court gentlemen up here next, because everyone wants to hear about the courts.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So, Bruce, can you come up? I probably don't want to, but we're going to have to talk about this, and then Eric, you are the 100-miler who is also neutral and the only other neutral person here, so why don't you come up, and I don't have any more neutrals, so you can wait, and let's hear from Bruce Miller at the state courts.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the office of the state court administrator. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department today. I'm not planning to make any comments on the original bill as drafted, but we do have some concerns with the -3 amendments that I'd like to point out to you. To give you some context, I want to run through the complexity of what these cases are. We don't know how complex the Metro UGB case is going to be because it hasn't been briefed yet. But we do know how complex the Urban and Rural Reserves case is, which is sitting in the court right now. So that case, you go back to 2007 when the reserves were formed by statute. Metro worked through that. June of 2010, their product went to the Land Conservation Development Commission. Then for over 2 years, that was in process between the two of those as they went back and forth. In September of 2012, petitions were filed in the Court of Appeals. Opening briefs were filed in October and November, fairly quickly after the petitions were filed. Answering briefs were filed in December of 2012. Oral argument was in January of 2013. The court has now been working on that case since then. Some things to keep in mind about that particular case. Number one, it was several years in process with Metro and LCDC. It's a case of first impression. These are new statutes and new regulations for which there's no case law. So it's a bit of uncharted waters for the court. It's complex. 22 petitioners, 7 respondents, all of them local governments, 25 assignments of error, 58 sub-assignments of error, 36,000 pages of record, complex fact patterns on specific tracts of land. It's likely the most complex case that the Court of Appeals has ever had. They've given the case their highest priority. They're working diligently and as fast as they can on it, but it's a big beast to work your way through. So, going back to the Dash 3 amendments, what they will do is take that kind of complex case and shove it into a very tight time box. And we're concerned about that for a couple of reasons. So the statute as written right now for reviewing Metro's UGB and the reserves requires the court to produce an opinion with the greatest possible expediency. We specifically negotiated that provision in 2007 because we understood that tighter timelines were going to be difficult. Now, in the LUBA cases, there are tighter timelines, 91 days to decision. But remember, in LUBA, you already have an appellate-type review going on through LUBA. So it's a court process where the product that comes to the Court of Appeals is in much better shape for the court to tackle and handle quickly. That will not happen here because it'll be something coming from the commission. Time limits like 105 days to decision can affect meaningful judicial review. It affects the pending case that's complex, and these are the biggest, most complex cases that we see, and it can delay other cases that require quick action. Because you're moving this up to the front, and it's going to take a lot of resource. So juvenile cases that require quick action, termination of parental rights, those sorts of cases get delayed in the process the more things that you put at the very front of the process. While we don't favor time limits for these type of cases, if you decide you're going to go that route, it would be helpful if you made the time limit substantially longer than 105 days. The other thing that the LUBA statutes on time to decision have is a safety valve so that in extraordinary circumstances, the court can make specific findings on the record as to why the case cannot be decided in that amount of time and allow additional time for it to be decided. So those would be two very helpful elements if you should go this route. Not that we want you to, but should you go that route. Those sorts of safety measures will help avoid unintended consequences affecting meaningful judicial review, which really is what everyone wants, is meaningful judicial review. Otherwise, why bring it to the courts? Thank you.
And Representative Holwood, do you want to ask your...
No, he spoke to my question.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Chair, okay. Can I ask a question now, or should I wait till...
Yeah, let's have Eric go first.
Okay.
What do you think?
Your call, Mr. Chair.
It's totally a different topic, though. Let's stay with the court issue. Let's just wait. Yeah.
Thank you, please. Chair. Could you speak to, you just mentioned that it would be nice to have a longer period of time if we were going to set a time limit. What would be, now obviously other people might disagree with what you would like, but what would you think be a more reasonable time limit to put on the court if we wanted a expedient but thorough process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, I'm not sure that I have an exact number of days for you. I know that we've been batting around maybe 180 days,
okay.
But that only works if you have the safety valve where it's an extraordinary circumstance, the court can make findings and can extend that time. Because you can imagine if we got another 36,000-page record, that is very difficult to process in a hurry.
I have a quick follow-up on the safety valve issue. You might have said this and I missed it. Is there already existing language for safety valve-type outlets when needed in the courts that we could just adopt and put into this if needed?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Unger, if you look at the LUBA statute, specifically 197.855 sub 3, there's a safety valve built in there for those cases. Those are the 91 days to decision, and they outline the process the court must go through to extend that amount of time. So that there is a template out there. Having said that, I don't know where the line is on separation of powers, you know, where you've gotten to the point where you've put an unreasonable burden on the court where they will complain or parties will complain.
I sort of assume one of the ways they do it is they say, oh, really? Okay, here's your fiscal. For us to really move it right up, you know, we're going to build like 3 new courthouses and a bunch of judges, and you're going to pay for it. So the fiscal comes in at $12 billion, something like that. Because you get the right to put a fiscal on it, I'm pretty sure.
I'm good. The fiscal question is my other question, and I don't know if the courts have had time to think about how much additional cost there would be if a timeline like this was put into place, or if there would be additional cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, those types of costs can be difficult to calculate because you have X number of judges. We are not going to get more judges on the Court of Appeals. We have our panel. Now it's 10, which is very helpful, and we thank the legislature for that, but they are one of, if not the busiest, mid-level appellate court in the nation, and they are way underwater. The 3 new judges, including one of your colleagues who is sworn in today, you can always send it to him.
That's what I was thinking. That's exactly what I was thinking.
6,000 pages for you.
That might be a separation of powers.
So what I'm saying is we have a closed system. You have X number of judges. They work in panels of 3. So you're going to have 3 judges there. The question is it helpful to have more staff attorneys, more clerks, or is it such a deliberative process that doesn't necessarily speed it up? Because it is, part of it is a lot of thinking and going through the stuff, and the judges have to do that on their own, a lot of it.
Thanks.
Representative Holdy.
Thanks. I don't know if this is a question or not, but I guess it is a question. I mean, how putting this 105-day limit on the courts, essentially, I'm wondering, right now the statute reads with the greatest possible expediency. So what's faster than that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that the court in these cases, and specifically in the reserves case, has moved that as fast as they are capable of moving. That's the fastest possible expediency. So then that leads us into the discussion on the safety valve if 105 is too short. If it's too long, then it's not a problem. The court will still do it as fast as it can, and if it can get it out in 90 days, it will. But in these cases, that's not going to happen. They're too big.
I guess I was just pointing out as to what's the point of the 105 days if you're already moving as fast as you can, and for us to say, no, that's not fast enough.
Well, here's the issue I want to try to delineate. There's 2 different court cases. That's the issue. Because they're commingled, and you're moving with the greatest blah 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 expediency on the one, the other one's waiting. The bill's about the other one that might actually be pretty easy and quick. We don't know, but because it's second in line, I don't think anybody's arguing we want to even change the timelines on the original one, particularly except to the extent it's tied to the UGB expansion. So, you know, it's intended to be a narrowly targeted deal to de-link them and deal with the one that is essentially less complicated, isn't a brand new law, is a normal UGB expansion. Now, there's some overlap because they're both in urban reserves and the UGB area, but I think that's where we're running into some issues probably. Is one's behind the other one, and some people want to get going on the latter.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, especially the bill as originally drafted, was clearly targeted at the Metro UGB case, which all the parties agreed to hold in abeyance because they understand that the reserves case has to be decided to know what is going to happen in the UGB case. They're interlinked in that fashion. The problem with the amendments, the Dash 3 amendments, they aren't targeted just to the Metro UGB bill. They make a general change that will affect all of the Metro UGB activities henceforth.
Perspective.
And they also, Section 4 specifically targets that particular case.
Reserves or UGB case?
UGB case.
Yeah, right.
But remember, the changes, Mr. Chair, the changes to the overall changes in Section 3 will apply not just to the UGB, but also to Metro's reserve actions.
Prospectively only.
Prospective.
Not the one that's currently being litigated.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Davis.
Thank you. But just to clarify, the urban rural reserves process is a process that's only undertaken every 20...
Well, so far,
30,
it's a one
this is the first
idea.
Time, and if this gets to finalization, it's not going to be redone for another. Yeah,
no,
I mean, it's going to be could be decades essentially. So we're going to be left with UGB
right
decisions.
Right now, we're at one per 150 some years.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, absolutely right. But the trouble is, they're so intermixed with what happens on the decisions of the reserves and how that affects what happens with the UGB. It makes it difficult to separate them. And I also think it indicates the complexity of the UGB case. We don't know yet because briefs aren't filed, but you know, I would be surprised if it's not complex. The Woodburn case was terribly complex and took a lot of court resource to resolve that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is very helpful and illuminating. I mean, this is complex stuff even for us to think about, I think. Okay, more questions for Bruce. I know we've got a bunch of other people here on the base bill and maybe the amendments. And we're not moving it today, so we can always maybe call Bruce back if he's willing to come back another day as we look at potential changes on timelines.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Happy to be involved however I can.
Okay. Thank you so much. Eric?
Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Klem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Kanzler. I'm with the City of Bend. I've submitted written comments, so I'll attempt to keep my oral comments short. In 2013, the legislature passed House Bill 2254 that addressed UGB planning and approval for non-metro cities. It was a very involved process. It added clarity and expediency in a number of regards. It's a much appreciated effort from the City of Bend. We've played roles both in devising that and also the implementation with the agency. That, in our perspective, moved the ball down the field in terms of making UGB planning and approval processes more orderly, more streamlined, more efficient. House Bill 4078, as everybody here knows, is just a metro bill, and as such, we don't have a position on the bill itself. But we're very interested in the proposal that's been put forth by Metro and as embodied in the Dash 3 amendments that offer something new to the game in terms of moving the ball down the court, but which do so only for a small subset of cities throughout the state, those that are in the metro area. What we're interested in seeing at some point, and I know this bill is too narrow to address this, is taking these sorts of policies and seeing how they could be applied for other cities, seeing how it could be applied as a statewide policy. Metro is certainly not the only area that is dealing with a long-term expansion. It has its own unique sets of circumstances, but you could argue the same for Bend. You could argue the same for any number of urban growth boundary expansions, where the unique circumstances and the extensive legal scrutiny of these processes can take a tremendous amount of time. The City of Bend has already been at its process for over 10 years, and it's going to be a number of years, regardless of what course of action we ultimately take. So as I said, I know that this bill is too narrow, and this is a newly introduced topic, but I would like, my hope today was to put this before you and to seek your consideration of addressing this as a matter of statewide policy, whether it's in another vehicle this session, whether it's in a discussion in the interim, or whether it's legislation in the 2015 session. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to get moving on to the rest of our panel here. So please, Any questions for Eric? Hopefully none. We'll talk to Eric again about this. Good, thank you. Okay, Pat, sorry about that, and Sean and Jeff. Pat, I've got you in the four category, that's right? Okay.
Chair Clement and committee members, my name is Pat Rebellia. For the record, I'm here to speak on behalf of Hag Lake LLC, Joe Hanauer, and he is one of the two larger landowners for the South Hillsborough area. He is one of those two partners that have been partnered not only with Metro and the City of Hillsborough for 17 years to get the housing development needed in that area. I've submitted written testimony on his behalf. You may have it, so I won't cover that. President Hughes and Mayor Doyle and Mayor Willie said it well. I won't repeat that. But on behalf of the Hag Lane, Mr. Hanauer, we support the Dash 3 amendments. Mr. Hanauer is, after 17 years, he's been a patient partner, and he would like to hopefully, through the Dash 3 amendments, get a resolution on this one. So thank you.
Okay. Sean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, Wetonkentorp. I think we have the solution to the problem of the Court of Appeals being bottled up, the original bill. It takes this case off of their docket, and so they won't have to worry about it. Obviously, we were supportive of the original bill, and it was the cleanest approach to solving a very complicated process, which is why you saw it drafted the way it was. That being said, I certainly appreciate the efforts of the Metro Council and the mayors behind us as we've discussed potential amendments as this process has been brought forward, obviously discussed in your committee in the interim as well, how we could possibly get somewhere. I think we might be close with the Dash 3s, but they're going to need a little more work from our perspective. And I have my client here with me, Jeff Backreck from Newland Homes, who can talk to you further about the 17 years they've been waiting and the certainty they're looking for to bring the development there. But, you know, the couple things I would address that have been brought up in the previous testimony, obviously our land use system is a process that the legislature created. You all are the ones who put the steps in the process, and it's obviously been changed numerous times. It would not be unprecedented for you all to come in and somehow help in the process, and you did that with 2254. Last session, this very committee worked on that. However, it excluded Metro from it. And so, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, we are looking at the more narrow focus of this particular UGB decision, not the broader urban and rural reserves decision that's pending before the Court of Appeals. We appreciate, though, the suggestions by Metro of prospective improvements to the land use process. With that, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you, Sean. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Backreck. I'm an attorney and project manager with Newland Communities, which is the largest property owner in the South Hillsborough expansion area. We own 460 acres and have been working. I'm not sure if it's 17 years, but it's long enough. I probably had hair. working with the City of Hillsborough, working with the Hillsborough School District, working with ODOT, working with myriad partners to build a large master plan community. And after all this time, the hope and expectation been we could begin work this year, begin work on what will probably be a $500 million investment over the next 5 years or so. The problem that's holding it up is the UGB appeal, and that's obviously why we're here. And I will talk about the amendments, but if you'll indulge me just for a moment or two, and I will be brief. Mayor Willie and Mayor Doyle, I think, did a good job of articulating what the problem is that brought this bill to your attention. And thank you, Representative Davis and Representative Clem, for bringing the bill to everyone's attention. The problem is there is an enormous amount of need for housing, an enormous amount of investment to date, not just by the private sector, but by the public sector. The school district has already purchased land for four school sites in South Hillsborough. You heard the Beaverton School District needs to build a high school. ODOT has recently approved a major regional road improvement with a permit that will expire in 2 years that my client's going to primarily fund. All that goes away. All that is going to get stalled for at best 3 or 4 years, and very likely more than that. So that's the problem that's on the table. an enormous public need, an enormous public investment in housing, economic development that's ready, bursting to move forward this year, and it's going to get stalled. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, we don't know, but those are reasonable estimates. And so the dilemma that led to this bill with the opponents who don't like to see the legislature intervene in a local legislative action, it's understandable. I've been a land use lawyer in Oregon for 25 years. I need the process. I work in the process. But I also understand, as Sean pointed out, there are times where the legislature needs to look at a land use process that you created. And when there are unique circumstances and when there's a compelling need, you do act. Not often. You try to do it judiciously. And I think we have a situation here. The need is compelling. You've heard it described. A huge investment, a huge need, a problem that's been stalled, really. We're talking about the 2011 UGB expansion that was supposed to have happened in 2007. So we're now 6-7 years and counting on getting this UGB expansion implemented. So that's the need. The unique circumstances are the urban reserve, again, a creature of the legislature, a 50-year decision that's now taking much, much longer to implement than everyone thought. And meanwhile, the small UGB decision is frozen. We're being held hostage to this enormous, complicated, 50-year, once-in-a-lifetime decision. So that's the unique circumstance. No one anticipated that one UGB process, one UGB decision, and a relatively small one, as you heard President Hughes describe it, is now being held hostage for some indefinite period of time, waiting for some indefinite outcome on urban reserves. And I think what's important for everyone to keep in mind is the, and I realize the bill as written is not going forward, but that bill did not affect urban reserves. That appeal would continue on its course. The outcome would be what it is. So all this bill attempted to do is a very narrow, taking the one UGB decision, setting us free so it's no longer a hostage to this bigger, longer, more complicated process. So that was the intent of the original bill. I haven't carefully looked at Dash 3, but I'm going to just be honest. I'm extremely skeptical. It solves that problem. It may help with some future process needs. But if we go back to the problem I've articulated that created 4078 in the first place, that's a unique, specific, one-time UGB problem. And I'm skeptical, though I will participate and I'll wait for Sean's guidance, that looking to the courts to solve that problem is going to be a tough way to solve it. It's ultimately a legislative action. You created the process. I hope you'll find that the problem is serious enough and unique enough that it warrants a one-time solution. And I don't know if the one-time solution is going to come out of a direction to the court. I'm happy to answer any questions about the process that's going on. Our development, I love to talk about it. This probably isn't the right forum to do that. That's the problem I hope you can find a solution to. If 4078 isn't the solution, maybe there is another one, but I'm not sure if it's directing the court. I'm skeptical that solves the immediate problem. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. Jeff, thank you for your testimony, and it has been a long time. One way we could, I guess, address this problem in a different way than House Bill 4078 addresses would be to de-link the UGB decision from the urban reserve decision and go back and make a decision around the UGB expansion based on the old rules rather than placing all the burden on the new rules. Would that kind of approach be something that would be more agreeable to you?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, thank you for the suggestion. I mean, we've racked our brains thinking of all ideas, including the one you articulated. That has some possibilities. The problem is, to do that, I think, requires some agile cooperation from Metro, from LCDC, and will probably, even if that all happened, it may well result in another round of appeals. So I'm not sure it solves the problem, which is we have an immediate need to implement and act on these decisions. And I'm not sure what you described can be done in a streamlined way that solves the problem. My fear would be it's just another process, another up and down appeals, 2, 3, 4 years. So I'm willing to explore anything. I'm willing to talk to anyone, anywhere, anyhow that might solve the problem, but I'm skeptical that gives us a solution today. Because if it's not a solution short-term, and all it's doing is fixing prospectively, it doesn't address the specific narrow problem that I thought we were trying to solve.
And then one more question.
I would just add one quick thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Unger. I think if you kicked it back and started all over, Metro already has their work plan for what they're going to be working on, plus they have the next round of periodic review that's coming up behind this. So to throw it back and start over, I think would cause a great deal of consternation amongst my friends behind us.
A follow-up question. I understand the need for speed, as it were, but what would you say, when Bruce was in here, he was describing the number of appellants, the number of, it sounds like there are lots of people who are concerned and don't necessarily agree with the decision and think it was actually done wrong. What would you say to those people who would like to have their day in court to be able to figure out whether or not the process was actually followed in the way that it was supposed to be done? And I know lots of people have testified to the fact that they believe they did it right, but there are people who disagree. And this bill in this original form would basically say, well, you people that disagree, well, too bad.
Chair Glenn Unger, thank you for that question. First of all, the case, I think it was Bruce, is it Miller?
Yeah.
He was referring to the Urban Reserve case, and I think it's important to keep clarity, and we all get confused between the Urban Reserve and the UGB. The Urban Reserve case was the one that had 22 briefs, that's now been at the court for well over a year, that's likely to continue in appeals and remands for several more years. But we're not touching that. That's a case of precedent, that's an enormously complicated and big case, and we're sort of saying we're setting that aside. So in response to your question, I wouldn't say anything to the parties in the Urban Reserve. Then God bless, Godspeed, and let's see what happens out of this incredibly complicated idea the legislature created. Switching to urban growth boundary, there are only three main appellants. They have very narrow issues for the most part. As concerns specifically South Hillsborough, we are not, according to the Department of Agriculture, prime farmland. So the issues, and I guess that's not answering your question directly, and I will try to do that. The issues are far more narrow in the UGB. There's well-established law that points to the answers to the issues that have been raised. Metro approved it unanimously. LCDC approved it unanimously. And I have to be careful in not mischaracterizing any of the appellants, but I think some of them are really appealing, waiting to see what happens in the Urban Reserve. I guess that's an awkward answer. Ultimately, you're right. There are people who have appealed the UGB who, under this bill, would lose a certain right they thought they had. But I would also say that's the nature of the land use process the legislature's created. More than once, you've reached into an existing land use process and said, for compelling public process reasons, we're going to, in effect, supersiting is not the right word, though I note you had to supersite to enable light rail to go through. You had to supersite for a women's prison. You interfered in a court process to protect land in Metolius River headwaters. So it's not unprecedented by any means for the legislature to reach down, make an important land use decision, and have people who were, in a sense, not given the process they thought they were given. But at least in this case, there was an exhaustive process, and you're not overruling local governments. You're upholding, you're validating a local government, and you're validating LCDC. But ultimately, yes, people will be mad at you if you adopt 4078. But you have to balance the equities, I guess, between...
Sometimes it's worth it, I can tell you. Yeah. Trust me. Oh, sorry.
He deviated from all listening to Sean and take his guidance.
I liked it. He got me more of it. He got another vote.
I'll start
because I know we have time.
It's balancing the equities between not acting. What's the downside versus if you do act?
And, oh, just really quick, the reason why I kind of asked those two questions in particular is that I don't think that the South Hillsborough site is actually under much dispute. And when it comes to the UGB boundary, the problem is it gets stuck because the Urban Reserve decision and the UGB decision, without them together, you couldn't probably have had the UGB decision that Metro made, because that North Hillsborough site is in prime farmland and probably wouldn't have fit under the old rule. So the reason why I asked all those questions is really to say, I'm happy to free you up.
but we can't free up that one.
Okay, I'm glad we had this talk.
But the one part that is in dispute is that North Hillsborough site, which it needs that first decision in order for us to get that second decision around the UGB, if I understand the experts who have talked to me correctly.
Professor Davis, did you?
I just make the comment that we are having a process as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes I think we forget.
The people who are affected aren't.
They voted for somebody around here. I don't know who, but so yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more questions for these nice gentlemen? Now we're going to go to a series of panels against. So we've done one for, one against, one for. Everything from here on out is against. So let's start with Dave Engen, Aileen Kay, and Larry Dyke. And I know the committee is supposed to end at 5, but I didn't, like, limit anybody to the correct times to get everybody equal time. So I'm going to stay here even if committee members have to leave until we get through this. And then my intention, just so folks know, is to carry this over and reschedule for next Tuesday, because the Thursday's pretty full, and the stuff we're talking about is going to take a few days, I think, to hash out. So if for whatever reason you're trying to track this bill, don't come back on Thursday expecting to hear about it. It'll be back next Tuesday.
How many more panels do we have?
And Mr.
How many more panels do we have after this?
So three of you, and then one, two, three, two more panels.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, those who are in the audience, I want to apologize. I do have I'm 5 minutes late already for a previous commitment, and I'm happy to meet with anybody in person or over the phone, and we'll listen to the rest of the testimony. But I want to honor that previous commitment. So, but thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Dave, one of my constituents. Let me have it.
Oh, no, I'm not going to let you have it. Representative Unger, Chair Clemmon. Vice Chair McCohen.
McEwen, thank you.
McEwen, thank you. And sorry, Representative Davis, I didn't miss your presence. But good luck to you in any case.
Thank you.
I'm just going to kind of rehash some of my experiences. I joined the United States Navy in 1959. I was put on active duty, and I was sent to a ship that was home ported in Port Chicago, California.
Hey, Dave, I got to have you say your name for the
record. Sorry. David Engen, and I live here in Salem. And as you know, I am one of your constituents. And anyway, I was sent to a ship home ported in Port Chicago, California, up the Sacramento River. And at that time, I had to make it, when the ship was in port, I had to make a trip into the city once a month to pick up the ship's secret material. And at that time, you could drive most of the way into the city and past farmland and trees and cattle. After I left active duty in 67, I went into the Merchant Marine and sailed as a deck officer, and the last ship I was on board was in the late 80s, and I was right back there. We were carrying munitions out of Port Chicago, a merchant ship. And at that time, that whole area that I used to drive through farmland was full of housing developments. It had all changed. And that really impressed me on what could happen if you're not really careful about what you do to your land and your farmland. Now, almost 50 years ago, I became a resident of the state of Oregon, and I have seen similar change happening, particularly in the around Portland area and in southern Oregon, and that kind of makes me nervous about what could happen. So I'll say it now, I'm opposed to anything that messes around with the public process for people to have their day in court. So I oppose the bill. That's all I have to say, and I hope that you folks do the right thing. Thank you.
Dave, do you have an opinion on the Dash 3 amendments, which are the timelines for the court to act?
Actually, I don't want the timelines put on courts. I think that's a bad idea because courts, well, as you know, we don't have enough judges, and we probably don't have enough courts. But nevertheless, they should be left to do what they're designed to do, and that is to carry the process through until they make a judgment. And they probably do a better job than most anybody else could do. I mean, I've known several of members of the Supreme Court, and I have a high opinion of those folks, and I also some of the other courts. As you know, my wife is an attorney.
I do.
But that,
and she's acted, I think, from the bench, too.
In any case, that's my testimony, and I certainly wish you folks well.
Okay. Aileen, you're next.
Chair Clem, members of the committee. I met with the Legislative Committee of the Marion County Democrats. We didn't know about the amendments at the time.
Aileen, so, sorry. Can you say your name as well?
Oh, I'm sorry. Aileen Kay, and I live in South Marion County. But I'm still concerned about this because it will impact the whole state if those timelines are changed with the court. So, anyway, last night we met and outlined why we didn't like the bill, and I have not had time to call any of them about the Dash 3 amendments. So I'll just make personal comments about those. I'm very concerned about the timeline with the courts because I don't know what the safety valve says. I was thinking, well, what if they don't meet the deadline? And so the gentleman from the court said that there's a safety valve, but I don't know how long that would be. So it's just scary that there would be one. Also, it was making me think about why we don't go to LUBA on these anymore. And why did that happen? And should we go back to the old way where I think these situations would have gone to LUBA before the Court of Appeals so that we're not overburdening the Court of Appeals? And also, I'm wondering, every session it just seems like our land use laws get chipped away a little more. And last session, 2254, I'm wondering if that made people like the developer who was sitting here race faster with his plans, thinking he can get away with it. I don't know. The last thing I'm going to say is, during lunch, I was in my car, I turned on the radio, and I heard Representative Davis talking on the radio to a radio talk show host. He was complaining about the yearly sessions and saying that these sessions are only supposed, this one in February, is only supposed to deal with housekeeping issues and budget issues, not complicated big land use changes. So I wish he was here because I would have asked him if he would reconsider this, even having this bill during this session. Thank you very much.
Larry.
My name is Larry Dyke. I'm a farmer. I'm a farmer from Washington County, and I really feel alone here, but I came today to talk to you about this process. I was involved with the process the whole way through. I was on the Washington County Committee, okay? The Washington County Committee that decided which would be rural and which would be urban. The committee was made up of approximately 15 city representatives and one farm representative. Myself and a friend of mine, Dave Van Ash, we both were able to sit at the table. They told us we could sit at the table together, but we only had one vote. Okay, so bottom line, you know, which to me always never made sense. Okay, if you have a vote of 15 to 2 or 15 to 1, how is there a difference? But anyway, that's the way it was. And we were reminded of that several times. So the process from Washington County, we never felt it was a fair process. The way the processes were ran at the other counties, they had more success. They had a better feeling. But Washington County, the heavy-handed of the Washington County commissioners to the farmers in that area, we did not have a chance. We participated, but how do you participate if you're always going to be outvoted? So any talk of eliminating the whole process, even of having our day in court, To me, is just, I mean, it's, it seems so bad. It really is hurtful. And Representative Davis, I mean, certainly the thought of doing that to me was, it was hurtful. It was very hurtful to just throw out the citizens, the farmers. And sometimes we feel like, sometimes the farmers in Washington County feel like the last Indians. You know, what do we have left? And if you listen to the talks today, everybody talk, the people all talking for about in favor of it, how many times is money representative? I thought this was like the Super Bowl when Peyton Manning's going, Omaha, Omaha, Omaha. It's money, money, money. We got to get the job done now. It's all about time. It's about money, which I can appreciate. But that's the people on that side. It's about money. Myself, personally, I farm in Roy. And I farm near North Plains. None of the property that I farm, property that I own or that I farm, none of it is affected by the urban reserves. I'm not here to say I want my property in because it's about money. That's, I'm not here for that. I love the land. I'm here because I want to protect the land. I would certainly be in favor of going back to the old process. The old process favored protection of the good farmland. The new process, and as we went through in Washington County, they set up a criteria of what land they wanted. They didn't want lands on slope. They didn't want lands in wetlands. They didn't want small partials. Okay? They wanted the big open spaces. They want the 330-acre space, which as a farmer, we said, hey, that's the land we want too. We don't want to farm little areas. We'd like to farm big areas. We'd like to farm areas that don't flood. We'd like to farm areas that are flat. But also, what's the best farm ground is the best ground to develop. Anyway, I would be in favor of going back to the old process. It helped protect the best farmland, and it also provided an orderly progression of the land. This new urban-rural reserves, so we have a 50-year supply. There's nothing that says they have to orderly progress from inside the city in a progressive manner. They can jump from where they are out, because it's all part of the 50-year reserve. There's no orderly progression required. Thank you very much.
Any questions for this panel?
I have a comment. I actually think that you're not alone in this thing, Chair, in this room, because Representative Holby oftentimes feels like he's one of the only dissenting votes against Chair Clem's horrible agenda. So you have... a friend in Representative Holby, at least.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now, in my defense, I went with Larry to one of those meetings, and I tried to get up there too. I got to talk somehow. I remember I got to talk, but I didn't get to vote. I know that. I threatened some people. We're not over with this. If you guys pass this, we'll be talking about it, and here we are.
So. And Brian, we went outside. I said, Brian, you did a great job, but they never heard a word you said.
I remember. I remember. Okay, moving on to less painful memories. Jody, is Jody still here? Jody Weiser, and do you two want to come together? Okay, Carrie, that's good. And Mary Kyle, please. The cookies weren't that bad, Larry, though. I mean, I had a pretty decent chocolate chip cookie, if I remember right. That meeting.
I can believe that.
Feed
you right, at least.
I didn't try to throw.
Although cookies in this committee would not be a bad idea. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I was just thinking. Yeah. You know,
we're going to go on for a couple works hours. Might as well some cookies.
Who did I have first? Jody, I have you first.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Pax Furnace, Oregon. We have been paying attention to land use issues the last few months because we've been working on the rural SIP issue. And so we've been listening, and what we've been hearing is this urgent need stuff that you heard from at least once today, and not really the patient capital arguments that were expressed. There's a piece of property near me that a few years ago could have sold as farmland. It recently sold with two zeros after that number, 100 times more money for the land because it's developable land inside the urban growth boundary. And anybody that owns that land in South Hillsborough and wants to get rid of the issue could easily sell it for the price of farmland, I am sure. It bothers me that we're talking about a process that would push these moneyed issues ahead of the human issues that our courts are supposed to deal with. And I think that the Dash 3s would do that. It doesn't make sense that a parent who doesn't know whether their child is going to be able to come visit them or live with them would wait while somebody is pushing a case that says, I want to know whether I can develop my property quicker. But I was paying attention to the needs, and the claims in Section 1-2 are that there's no land that's been added to the Metro UGB since 2002. But how can that be true? Industrial acres have been added to the Portland Metro UGB since December 1st, 2002. 5,302 acres are the number of acres we got zoned industrial by looking at Metro's website, being on the phone with them and getting emails from them. That there may be other versions of what that number would be, but I imagine it's in that area. I think only one group of those acres, about 330 acres of it, is under dispute. Genentech, we know acres have come in because Genentech built on 7 acres. That's how they got the rural SIP. Those acres came in after December 1st, 2002. And only some of these many, many, many acres available for industrial development are under dispute. The same would be true for housing acres. Meanwhile, while there's this urgency, much of the industrial land is remaining vacant. It's been vacant for years. In fact, on December 13th, the owners of a parcel of 74 acres, one owner, 74 acres, really close to Sunset Highway and Brockwood, asked to partition their acreage into 9 parcels instead of one industrial plot of 74 acres. They are probably doing that because they're tired of waiting. The for sale sign, the certified sign, has been on that property for a long time. And actually, the need doesn't seem to exist for the land that has already been approved. In addition, when I drive around Washington County, I am always just shocked at how close the houses are together and how little green space there is in the housing parts of the county. But it's clear we have no density requirements for the industrial parts of the county, or the industrial parks have all sorts of green spaces between the parking strips and stuff like that. Why aren't we developing? Why aren't we asking for some density when industry builds in our urban core, the way we ask it for when housing is built in our urban core? The biggest justification I see is when I go down the road and on one side is the Nike campus. They could have put a whole building on just the berm that gives them privacy. And across the street, there are houses being built, and it looks like they're about this far apart, the two walls. I'm not sure why they didn't just make common walls on them. It's kind of ridiculous looking, the two sides of the street, the two uses of land. And so, although that's not anything for this committee to consider with this bill, I think it's something that you should consider in the future. We know if we drive around the urban part of our state that we pass many signs of industrial land with for sale signs on them, and they've been for sale for a long time. Likewise, when I drive out of Salem to go home, within the city of Salem, I pass a large parcel that has now had its sign replaced 3 times. It's available for development, and it's a good-sized piece of property. It looks like it's between 7 and 10 acres. So you've heard about, you hear urgency about the need for industrial land, but it doesn't seem to actually exist in reality. And the same would be, I would say, about the claim that Beaverton Schools desperately needs land for a new high school in South Beaverton. The truth is, there's only one of many high schools in the below Sunset Highway that isn't under capacity or seriously under capacity. Alloa is at 102% of capacity. North of the freeway, every high school is already full, up to 124% of capacity. And the district owns land that they could build on north of the freeway. It's a matter in either case of shifting boundaries to fill schools. And it makes no sense to say we have to have the land in South Beaverton when we have land that we could be building on in the north part of the Beaverton School District. Further, I'm not sure about in the original bill, the way sections 2 and 3 mix. I think that somebody who has a legal mind needs to look carefully at that and unintended consequences, because it seems to say that this opens up all decisions made after January 2012, but I have no legal background. So I just make that caveat when I make that statement. The handout that you have did not come from Tax Fairness Oregon. It came from a website that I found online, and it's but it shows the picture of industrial land in Washington County, and I think it's a rather persuasive argument. Really, we don't need large lots a whole lot, and there is plenty of land available now. Thank you.
Who's next? Carrie, I've got you next.
Thank you. Chair Clem, Vice Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Given the hour, I'm going to sort of echo, I think, the comments that President Hughes made about the reasons why the department has concerns about the bill and sort of legislative action stepping in to validate an urban growth boundary process. We've submitted written testimony which lays that out in more detail, and I'm happy to answer any questions about it, but the department echoes those concerns. Make a couple of comments briefly about there have been a number of comments that have been made about the intersection between the urban growth boundary process and the also pending urban and rural reserves decision. And I think that there are some complications there about how those two decisions are nestled together that we want to take a closer look at with respect to particularly the Dash 3 amendments. We have, and mostly actually thanks to this committee running a little bit long, have had an opportunity to review the Dash 3 amendments. I do think that those are focused in a better direction, which is how do we make the process move faster and more efficiently to reach the decisions that we need to make for the metro region. We do have some concerns about the specific deadlines that are called out in the bill. If I share the experience of the last UGB decision, which is the one presently the committee is considering, that decision took us almost exactly 180 days to reach from the time the commission reached the final order. That was with considerable additional concerted effort, and is one that is hard to replicate. These are complicated decisions, and they take a fair amount of time after our commission has reached their decision to do the legal analysis to sustain a decision before the Court of Appeals. We'll leave it to the court to comment on what those timelines mean for them. I do want to note, just because there has been some testimony in related to our House Bill 2254, that process actually has the commission setting up the policy for urban growth boundary decisions, and future decisions under that process would be reviewed by the Land Use Board of Appeals and then sent to the Court of Appeals. So to the extent that this bleeds over into other discussions, I just wanted to clarify that point. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about the bill, but I think our written testimony covers most of the topics I would want to cover.
So on the Dash 3s, if we didn't do anything prospectively for future cases and we just dealt with this, you have no role then, because your commission already approved it unanimously, so we wouldn't have any impact on the agency if we put timelines on the courts for the UGB appeal.
Chair Klem, members of the committee, know that the commission has already reached its final decision in the matter. That's what's being held in abeyance of the Court of Appeals right now. So we don't have, unless it is remanded, in which case actually we have prescribed timelines to address it, we don't have further action on that matter.
Actually, this is kind of just dawning on me because I just saw the dash of these two relatively recently. They're trying to take on a bigger issue, too, at the same time as this one, which is let's, for all future cases, do it. That's not really critical to what we're talking about with some of these gentlemen. This committee doesn't have to take up that issue right now. We can do that in 2015 even. And that would then take away some of your concerns about the things I assume you were just talking about on timelines are about the prospective parts of the bill, not about how that would apply in this particular court case, because you're not involved in it anymore, except remand.
Chair Klem, members of the committee, you're correct, and we're involved in it in the sense that we are defending the decision. There are costs attributed to that, but those aren't part of this process. My comments are the prospective part, and I would also, and I didn't do this actually very well as I was preparing the written testimony, but noticed it as I was sitting in the audience. The prospective part of this, of the Dash 3s, include both reserves decisions and UGB decisions. And I think it's important to look at those differently. And I don't disagree that as of yet we really have one reserves decision that has, in 150 years. I think we actually had two, but that one didn't make it through the Court of Appeals the first time around. It isn't something...
75 years average.
We just got it half. It's not something which happens often, but when it does happen, it's a big... To put it in perspective, it was over a 160-page single-spaced order. I do think it took our department too long to render a final decision. I will say that. But I'm not sure that it could have been made exponentially faster. I think we want to look more carefully. We want to talk with MetroSum about the difference between those two. I recognize, in terms of immediacy, I'm not planning on seeing another reserves decision before me anytime soon. But it is a matter that if this bill were going to receive additional work and attention, that I would want to put some thought to.
Yeah, good. Right.
Chair Klem, Vice Chair McEwen, and member of the committee.
Thanks for my room.
Thank you. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and here to talk in opposition to House Bill 4078. I will briefly address the original bill and then the Dash 3s. I want to make very clear some things that I think were muddied by earlier speakers. This legislation, the land that this legislation as proposed would supersite as a UGB, is completely tied to the urban reserves. Those 2,000-odd acres are designated as urban reserves, and therefore, if that UGB was supersited by this bill, that would undermine the urban and rural reserves litigation that's currently going on that has all those 22 parties you heard about. It's not simply narrowly addressed to those 2,000 acres because some of those acres are at issue in that urban reserves case. And I want to make that clear. I think there was an impression given that maybe somehow they weren't connected on the ground, but they are. Also, as a legal matter, Metro has put itself into the position it finds itself and that has prompted this bill. Metro made a decision to adopt urban and rural reserves. LCDC approved it, and that has been appealed to the Court of Appeals, and you heard the description of that from the Court Administrator's office. Metro then later, while that appeal was pending, made a UGB decision to expand the UGB by these roughly 2,000 acres, might be more like 1,800. Metro chose to make that UGB decision legally dependent on the legality of urban reserves. It did not have to do that. As Representative Unger alluded to, they could have made a UGB expansion the old-fashioned way. In that case, farmland is the last choice for a UGB expansion. Some of those acres would have been difficult to justify, but not all of them, probably. Metro could have made alternative findings. It did not. It made its UGB decision entirely dependent on the legality of urban reserves. It put itself in this position. So I think this is not necessarily a problem for the legislature to solve. This is
a problem that Metro has put itself into. And therefore, it does impact the urban reserve litigation. As you've also heard, Metro is now considering, and by the end of 2014, will make another decision on whether or not it needs an urban growth boundary expansion. Turning to the school district issue, the Beaverton School District has made very clear that they are not part of this bill that was proposed. They don't want it. They weren't expecting it, and they're not particularly happy with it, and they have their own standalone UGB amendment before Metro. One can get and apply for standalone UGB amendments before Metro for some uses, including schools. Metro chose not to make a more conservative, smaller UGB expansion that did not rely on urban reserves. So that's why we are here today. Why do we also oppose House Bill 4078? And I've written testimony that I will give to you. We think it creates a slippery precedent of legislative involvement in local land use decision-making and in a pending judicial proceeding. Both cases are still before the Court of Appeals. You've heard from previous people testifying that the ability of citizens to appeal government decisions that they believe are illegal is a basic right of our system of government. It's something that puts trust in the governmental process by citizens, and it's not just in the area of land use law. This proposed legislation is contrary to the right of citizens to have their day in court. As you heard President Hughes describe, Metro and many other parties, including 1,000 Friends, the Farm Bureau, the development community, agreed to a reserves process that included the right of appeal. We all held hands on that reserves process, and some of us are not so happy with the way it turned out. But going into it, we didn't know who was going to be happy and who was going to be unhappy. And in fact, those appealing the reserves decision include land developers, two cities, farmers, individual landowners from all across the spectrum. There's a fair amount of unease about and question of the legality of the reserves decision. And in fact, Clackamas County and Multnomah County did not sign on to the agreement with Washington County's designation of urban reserves. That right of appeal was part of the legislation we all agreed to, and we're now in that right of appeal. We all signed on to that. And if this legislation is passed that doesn't end run around that process, there will be no reason for individuals or organizations to participate in the future in crafting things like the Urban and Rural Reserves Program that we all hoped would work. But to see the development community come forth now because they're waiting because of an appeal will, I think, just quash the ability of, or interest of citizens to participate in the future. And those 17 years that one particular developer has been waiting to develop their land, that land has been zoned for exclusive farm use that entire time. They bought exclusive farm use land, and it might or might not ever come into the urban growth boundary. And I did want to correct another thing that was said and also is an incorrect statement, as Jody Weiser pointed out, in House Bill 4078, as it's currently drafted and as it would still remain after the amendments, because all the first page reciting what Metro has done is in there. Metro has, in fact, expanded the urban growth boundary in 2002, 2004, 2005 for a total of 21,000 and some odd acres, including 98 parcels of large lot industrial sites. Only four of them have been developed for residential use, and one of them has been developed for an industrial use. And we did not appeal any of those. I'm not sure if any of them were appealed, but we didn't appeal them. Those are all short of the current urban growth boundary expansion that's before you now. We think interfering with a court decision while it's still pending before the court sets a very slippery slope precedent, and not just for land use. Turning to the Dash 3s, there's three parts to the Dash 3 amendments. I think it's Section 2 sets time frames on LCDC, on the commission, issuing its written decision after it has made an oral decision at a hearing. We are comfortable with appropriate time limits on LCDC. Once it's gone through the process, it's considered, it's heard the parties before it, it's made its decision to issue that written decision. I think Carrie McLaren has talked about whether 120 days or some other period is reasonable. But the other two sections deal with time constraints on the Court of Appeals. And we suggest that the legislature entering into that is both unnecessary and unwise, because The legislature has already, in our view, taken two very significant steps to address the court's backlog. The Oregon Court of Appeals has been rated as the busiest in the nation, according to national court statistics, for well over a decade. And many cases in every area of law can take a long time at the Court of Appeals, not just land use. But last session, this legislature, I think, already took the most important step it could have to help solve this, and that was to create and fund three new judge positions at the Court of Appeals. That is going to make a significant impact on the court's processing of all decisions. And as you heard, there's many more pressing decisions than land use or in addition to land use before the court. That's a significant step. The other step that the legislature took last session was to pass 2254. LCDC is engaged in rulemaking, and there's a deadline on when they have to finish that rulemaking of 2015. That legislation provides a more standardized, faster option for cities to determine whether or not they need a UGB expansion. Any decision made under that option will go to LUBA, not to LCDC, and then to the Court of Appeals. As you've also heard from the court, a major problem that has been for the last decade or so, UGB expansions have gone to LCDC and then to the court. LCDC is a policy body, not a judicial body. It's not well suited to crafting land-specific judicial-type decisions for judicial review. In contrast, decisions that go from LUBA to the Court of Appeals have been written by an administrative judicial body and present a clear decision for the court to evaluate. House Bill 2254 should result in more UGB decisions going to LUBA and then to the court, and that will help the court's overall workload. Metro chose not to be part of 2254 and to have their decisions still go to LCDC and to the Court of Appeals. They can certainly become part of House Bill 2254 and have those decisions go to LUBA where they used to go. The last time I, many years ago, appealed a Metro UGB decision, it went to LUBA. And I would want to clarify one thing about the dash threes. There are about a half a dozen, maybe more, cities around the state that do have urban reserves. Others have considering them. They've been expanded by other cities. This bill, the dash threes, would apply to future urban reserve expansions as well as designations as I've seen it written. I will also claim that I also just got those, so I reserve the right to be wrong. But I think it does affect the designation and expansion of urban reserves by other cities. And Metro can designate additional urban reserves or expand their existing urban reserves as soon as the current ones are finished. I mean, there's nothing in the legislation about urban reserves that limits the amount, the frequency with which Metro could add additional urban reserves. I'm not saying that would be something they'd necessarily do, but there isn't a limit to them there. I think that's it. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And last panel, Roxanne Ross, if you're still here, and Randy Tucker. Did we lose Roxanne? One person I didn't know who that was.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yep. Members of the committee, Randy Tucker with Metro. I was just going to come up and respond to a couple of comments, just specifically about the amendment itself, just to clarify. I think I'll pass on that opportunity right now because I believe there are other amendments. There will probably be changes to this amendment. And so rather than taking any more time at this hour, I'll just waive that opportunity unless you have specific questions about the amendment itself, the proposed amendment.
Questions?
Well, none. I think we'll have more time to talk about it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in that vein, I'm going to close the public hearing on House. Scott Barry, you want to testify?
Well, hop on up.
If you didn't have some sort of, where are those wooden crutches I saw over the weekend?
Handcrafted out of teak, Mr. Chair.
I told you I'd loan you. I have the normal ones with the rubber and the metal, but you think those look better.
Those are, Chair Clem, Scott Barry for the record, on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. Those are my dress crutches, so whenever I'm up testifying, I bring the dress crutches.
All right.
Noted.
Gotcha. Okay.
Looking for more sympathy or anything else I might be able to get.
All right, you can go.
Looks like
go
I might
ahead.
Need some for this bill. Again, Scott Berry, on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, in support of the original bill, potentially in support of some amendments. As you know, Mr. Chandler normally testifies on land use issues. Unfortunately, he is in Nevada's largest city, working diligently on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. We'll be back soon. And if I was Mr. Chandler, I'd be happy to answer any questions for you.
Is there any way I could like get like about $50 on Black 12? Can you call him real quick? I'm feeling lucky. Any questions for our home builders? Okay. No, thank you.
Very nice crutches, though.
Yeah, those are nice crutches.
Extraordinarily nice.
Committee would officially like to commend them, but we don't have a quorum. So anybody else that I missed in my... Everybody else? Okay. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4078. I'm not going to carry it over because we're not going to deal with it on Thursday because we have too much other stuff to do and a lot of conversations. So our plan is to repost it, which we will do relatively soon here, for next Tuesday. So don't come here on Thursday to talk about 4078 because you'll be disappointed. All right. And with that, I'll adjourn the committee. Adjourn the committee.